Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Warnerd. The day today is March 10th, 2026, and this is episode 588. I am the co-host, Mark Ames, out in Western New York. You're listening to Radio Warnerd. Subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnerd. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warnerd, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Puglia, Italy. How you doing, John? I saw a map of U.S. air bases in Italy, or bases, and there are a lot of them. But lucky for you, none of them are in the Puglia area.
Yeah. If we get bombed, then I'm sure we will before I have the good sense to die of old age, then... maybe somebody will spare us, but
For some reason, the U.S. I was really surprised. We have a lot of bases there. Maybe someday we'll ask Anibale about this. Mostly in the center of the country and kind of the north center, northeast, but not on the northwest, which I guess makes more sense because the kind of more radical left wing parts of Italy tend to be in the northwest or in the western coast, right? Genoa, Turin, Bologna, this kind
Genoa,
of
Genoa, yes, yeah. Definitely. It's a very student-y, leftist kind of place, as I sort of noticed when I got my arm smashed. Non-violently, just tripped. that's all.
That's right, in Genoa. So, okay, obviously we got to talk about this ever-widening, insane war that's going on over Iran and the rest of the whole region. I have to say, John, I know whatever hit you early on in this war in a weird way hit me late last night, that sense of it's like a depressed rage where you're simultaneously absolutely enraged and depressed. And you can't think straight except for the rage and depression. I at least maybe deluded myself into at least feeling a sense of, I don't know, kind of clarity about this because the war went so much according to how it seemed so obvious it was going to go. But some things yesterday that are just so obscene. I mean, seeing Trump and Hegseth, Trump, at least how he's talking, and I don't think this is entirely an act. Trump thinks the war is going great and he's completely in control of everything. He has everybody in the palm of his hand and he decides who and when to squish. And he's enjoying himself. And it's really
He's very
disgusting.
Much enjoying himself as his blurts, I don't even want to call them, appearances have done, have shown rather that this is a thrill to him because people are lying to him within the little bubble of the administration.
Yeah. To that end, let's play a clip of Trump gloating about killing sinking that ship in, off of Sri Lanka, the Iranian ship, and killing, I don't know, well over 100 sailors. This is an unarmed ship. And this is Trump talking to a bunch of Florida Republicans, I believe it was. So play this clip if you can, Brendan.
The Navy is gone. It's all lying at the bottom of the ocean. 46 ships. Can you believe it? In fact, I got a little upset with our people. I said, what quality of ship? Excellent, sir. Top of the line. I said, why did we just capture the ship? We could have used it. Why did we sink them? They said, it's more fun to sink them. I said, that's a... They like sinking them better. They say it's safer to sink them. I guess it's probably true.
Yeah, so that's Trump. And you heard the laughing, the sort of gloating laughing in the audience.
Really far too many people have been on board with everything.
Yeah.
I don't know if the media always behaved that way, and I simply didn't care before. But they're patriotic in a carnivore sort of way that is really repellent.
There's only one minor difference, I would say, which a few people I think have pointed out, which is that there does seem to be some hand-wringing, at least, over the fact that the U.S. was the one that actually bombed the Iranian girls' elementary school that killed, I don't know, roughly 180 people, 165 children. At first, Israel was happy to take the blame. They're like, what, you know, what's, it's no skin off our backs. We've already committed a genocide. And they were happy to kind of run cover for the U.S. But people stopped believing in it, and there's been more and more evidence that the U.S. was behind it. And now, even Bellingcat, even NATO's own propaganda arm, Bellingcat came out and verified that it was almost certainly a U.S. tomahawk. They actually have a still photos of the tomahawk from video that was released by Iran of a tomahawk missile.
And I remember pretty definitely that the early stories said the school was part of the American targets,
yes,
not the Israeli targets.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there was talk that it may have even been Claude or, you know, the AI, that because whoever targeted it was going off 10-plus-year-old maps. And that could just as easily have been human and you know, trying to pass it off. I mean, what does the military do? What do people in D.C. do? You just pass blame around to other people always. I mean, you don't rise that high without learning how to do that. But yeah, it's for sure. And there was a double tap. There was a second bombing 40 minutes later to get the rescue people. But this is actually bothering people. And it's the one incident that the media is kind of investigating. Not all of them, of course. Barry Weiss's CBS is making sure to never talk about it. Or if they talk about it, only to say that the U.S. denies it has any role in it. But the rest are. I think you see the difference between what happens when Israel commits a war crime and kills a bunch of children versus America. They're allowed to investigate a little bit and criticize America a little bit. But if it's Israel that does it, even Bellingcat, I remember, ran a disinformation campaign claiming it was probably a Hamas or a PIJ missile that landed on that hospital early in the war that killed, you know, many, many Palestinians.
Oh, the one in Gaza. Yeah,
the one in Gaza. I'm sorry. Yeah, that, you remember, it was the first big atrocity.
Yeah, and after that, it just became, another hospital, another day.
But there was a huge effort to, obfuscate and deny and disinformation, misinformation, and Bellingcat was part of that. Since then, Israel has so openly demolished every hospital it can that nobody doubts it anymore. But there is a difference here. If Israel commits war crimes, the American press won't go near it. If the U.S. commits a war crime, some elements of the U.S. press might raise it or talk about it a little bit. And that's pretty weird. It's a weird time.
It's got to be unprecedented in the global history of so-called great powers.
Yeah, what great power? I mean, anyway, let's bring it back to the war and kind of do the overview of the war right now since we're on day 11. The first thing we should point out, I think, is that at least according to Iranian officials and at least 1,300 Iranians have been killed so far. That includes, of course, the 100 and roughly 80 people killed by the American Tomahawk in the elementary school. And then also, I think it was just in the last 24 hours, 40 Iranians in Tehran were killed when Israel collapsed a residential building. And oil prices were going through the roof. They soared from the 80s, upper 80s to, I mean, oil prices had been inching up, but not soaring in the first several days. And I watched some Bloomberg News, and I've been keeping an eye on the capitalist press, and they had this kind of weird sense that there's no way that this is really going to get out of hand. And so I don't want to be caught bidding something up and then holding on to overly expensive oil. Like they couldn't believe that it's as dumb and bad as it really is. And Trump has been lucky, so they're not betting against him. I mean, this just shows that even the capitalists can be as deluded as anybody. And suddenly it started to hit them. It just started to hit them really yesterday morning that Trump doesn't have control of this war.
In fact, Trump is a loon. I mean, a genuine loon.
Yep. That he's a loon, that he's very dangerous, that we don't know where this war is going, and that actually the Iranians have much more capacity than they've wanted to believe. Now, I think these people are still very deeply deluded, but I don't think they still at all really fully grasp how catastrophic this is going to be as it goes on, and it's not going to end. Trump doesn't have a switch that he can turn off with his whim because the Iranians are not playing by that anymore, as we've talked about.
No. There was an episode, very minor episode, but interesting sociologically, that revealed how Trump thinks and why he stomped the fellow blowhards of his own culture in those debates early on, but that he does not know when he's dealing with a bluff from the Iranians and when he's not.
Yep.
Like, there was an Iranian foreign ministry interview, I think, the foreign minister said...
I have the quote right here from your notes. So it's Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, posted on X that, quote, 9 days into Operation Epic Mistake, instead of Epic Fury, or Epstein Fury, as others have called it, oil prices have doubled while all commodities are skyrocketing. We know the U.S. is plotting against our oil and nuclear sites in hopes of containing huge inflationary shock. Iran is fully prepared, and we, too, have many surprises in store. And this, as you said, John, is not a bluff. And what's, again, it's so clear, and we've been saying this actually even just before this war started, that people like Trump and Hegseth and even Netanyahu have completely misinterpreted, maybe in Netanyahu's case deliberately, misinterpreted Iran's restraint in the previous engagements. And they were very restrained deliberately because they've had a policy going back to Ayatollah Khomeini back in the 80s to try to avoid direct confrontations with the U.S. and even Israel because... And that, in a kind of head-to-head, they can't win. It's going to be harmful. So try to dial it down and keep cutting them with 1,000 cuts if you can suck them in somewhere. But this time around, the Iranians realized that that has sent all the wrong signals and that this will not end unless the Americans and Israelis are taught a brutal lesson. And so the Iranian state, anyway, the IRI, is absolutely willing to take an enormous amount of pain in order to inflict an enormous amount of pain in order to get some kind of settlement that they believe will safeguard them in the future. And that's what we're seeing, right?
Which is not a bluff. And it's in some ways an understatement. The opposite of a bluff. And Trump can't hear that. And his response was very telling. He said something to the effect of, see, we've got him on the run now.
Yes. Yeah.
He knows nothing about people from other cultures, especially ones that have a sort of 17th century, kind of lethal courtesy. Do you say that?
Huh. Yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah, understatement doesn't really work, doesn't get across to Trump. And he also might not even take bluster seriously, but I think he does take seriously seeing his rich friends calling and screaming at him about this war. And that is definitely happening. I mean, you saw this billionaire from the UAE yesterday. Was it yesterday? Yeah, it was yesterday. posting on X because they don't know how else to reach him, telling Trump, you're trying to suck the UAE in this war. We're not going in. This is a complete disaster, and you have to find a way out of this. This is like, this is causing enormous damage to the Gulf states. Enormous. We've talked about, and to the economies of the world, particularly Asia. As we've said, the Gulf states have had to massively reduce or even close up oil production. That causes, when they can't get the oil out and they can't store any more oil or other stuff that's being produced, they can't store it somewhere on barges or in depots. They can't store it anywhere, then they have to actually plug up their oil wells and their oil production facilities. And it's, as somebody described them, these are not, it's not just a switch that you flip on and off. It's not a faucet that you turn on and off. It's a giant chemistry set, a giant chemistry lab. Mm. And so when you shut it down, all kinds of other chemical reactions start to happen. And I read that one of the big dangers is paraffin starts to develop in the well and block it up. And it's very hard to then clear out the paraffin whenever the war ends. And I don't think it's going to end for quite a while. And the longer the war goes on and the longer these production sites are closed down, the more damage, long-term damage, is done to them. So as I was saying, oil jumped briefly. Brent crude, which is the kind of the European, kind of the main benchmark for the world, jumped to about 120, I think, at some point. And there were reports that Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, who used to work for Soros, who used to attack currencies for Soros, he helped Soros bring down the destroy the British pound so that it couldn't be part of the euro. If you remember, in the early 90s when the pound got knocked out, that was Bessent and Soros who did that. They made $1 billion off that. So wow. What they've done is they have, what Bessent ordered Treasury to do was to attack oil traders who are making Trump look bad. So oil traders are getting scared. Speculators get involved as well. They drive up the price to 120. Panic grips all the markets. Then Treasury comes in with its tens of billions of dollars that it can throw into the market and starts to short oil. And what that means is basically it drives the price down and hurts people who are speculating on the price moving up. So what they want to do is burn these people hard so that they won't drive it up again. So Treasury got in, started massively shorting the oil market and oil futures. And then Trump comes in yesterday around like 3:30, just before the markets closed, and said, I think the war's over. I think it's done now. We've done everything we wanted to. And that caused, along with the Treasury shorting, the oil market to drop like $25, $30 a barrel, like a massive collapse that burned the hell out of all these people who were driving it up. And so now oil traders are really kind of afraid to drive it up, even though production has been taken off market. So it's a really weird situation where the U.S. government is intervening in markets, so we don't even really know what the actual price is or should be. For short-term gains, so that Trump looks good for now, and it would hold if this war ends in 5 days, that might hold. But eventually, all those positions taken by Treasury, if oil goes up again, the Treasury, that is the U.S. taxpayer, could be on the hook for, I don't know, tens of billions of dollars if the oil price goes up again. So this is the kind of reckless shit that Trump is doing to look okay. I mean, if you remember yesterday, so about 3:30 before markets closed, he drove the price down, then waited till after markets closed and said, or I might actually expand the war and rain hell on them. And wow. So, yeah, it was so blatant. And there's no doubt whatsoever that Trump insiders also made money on this. People on the inside, knowing what they were going to do to the market, placed bets on the side.
My question would have been, aren't those his kind of people? Doesn't he like speculators?
They don't like anybody who makes them look bad.
Right.
Yeah, there is. He doesn't like anybody who makes him look bad. And he doesn't care. I mean, Trump's sense about where he is in relation to others is, I'm the most powerful man in the world. You're always going to come back to me. I control the most money in the world, the most weapons in the world. You will always come back to me because I can cause you so much more pain than you can to me. That's his feeling. Yeah. I don't know.
It's probably true. I mean, I guess it is.
True, yeah.
In fact, everybody who voted for that made it come true quickly.
Yes.
It's weird. It's a weird situation.
It is. It is. So just this morning, to show that Iran is still in it and is still acting on Iran, you know, the Hormuz Strait is still shut. So we have a situation now where oil output is cut so much that it's now down 6.5% of global oil production is supply is now cut because of this war and because of how important the Strait of Hormuz is. To give you a sense of how large that is and how devastating it is, in 1973, that whole oil shock that caused gasoline prices to quadruple, that was from a 7% cut. So we're almost there already in terms of how much oil has been taken off the market. But we're nowhere near there in terms of the effect for a whole variety of reasons. But these effects will be hitting in time, in waves, like it or not. And again, it's not just the oil and it's not just the liquefied natural gas. Like, for example, jet fuel. Jet fuel has, and they haven't been able to do anything about it, jet fuel is now so expensive. I think it's like tripled in price. And it has to do with the Asian spot market. It has to do with how jet fuel is refined and how many refineries there are and what producers are hooked up with the refiners of Asian jet fuel so that there's basically just not enough oil to refine into jet fuel right now. So it's gone through the absolute roof. So that's going to translate into greater havoc in the commercial air markets, air cargo and air travel is going to go through the roof. As I said, the Iranians just this morning, I mean, we keep saying how much we've degraded the U.S., how much we've degraded Iran's missile strikes and drone strikes. I mean, they are down substantially from the first days of the war. I'm just going to say this up front, John. It doesn't matter for what Iran needs to do.
The photos out of Tel Aviv are stunning.
Yes. Yeah.
I never imagined anyone would do that to central Israel in my lifetime.
Yeah. So they don't need to launch as many salvos as they did in the first couple of days in order to keep the Strait of Hormuz closed, in order to regularly, on a steady, low pace, hit refining, very fragile, vulnerable refining facilities, even bases, hotels, like basically to cause havoc. And remember, the UAE especially, but also the Saudis, Qatar, these people rely so much on rich world expertise, advisors, money. The reputation, particularly of the UAE, is as one of the safest places in the world. You can park all your gold there, park all your money there. The expat community, not just these sort of
slave level. So many British quasi celebrities were truly shocked. And I don't know if this is specific to the culture of the UK, but they had the same reaction when their habit of voting to withdraw from the EU came back to bite them, and they were invited out of Spain, for example. It was like, hey, this was supposed to be a safe place. What's going on? Now I have to get a plane, and there is none.
People trying to flee, same with Bahrain. And this will not be forgotten for a long time. There will be the cowboy types will always come back, people who need money, who are attracted by high pay, but people aren't going to move there and hang out there thinking this is a safe place anymore. And they do have, especially the UAE, has a lot of wealthy people. And it's not just Westerners, Russians. Now, Russians will probably be less scared of this, knowing Russians, than Westerners. But, you know, if you have a family there, you're going to think twice about raising your kids there. A big part of this story that is, I did not think, this is not something I imagined, I have to admit, I don't know if you did, is how many radar units or, you know, facilities that Iran has taken out. A lot of THAAD radar, including THAAD radar in Ruwais. So this refinery that Iran just hit today with a drone, they were able to hit it with the drone because earlier they'd taken out radar in UAE, among other places. And they even took out a THAAD radar. And remember, there are only 7 or 8 THAAD systems in the world. And I think we had moved 5 of them to the region for this war, including what we have in Israel. And they've been basically blinded. The Iranians have taken out THAAD radar systems in Jordan, which is used to track and hit missiles, basically going up to the atmosphere, but ballistic missiles heading towards Israel. And this is why Israel is getting hit a lot more. And from what I'm hearing, you know, we have a family friend there. I've watched what Radio Warner guest Ori Goldberg has been saying. They're not getting warnings anymore. They're not getting the same warnings, and more missiles are hitting because they're partly blinded. The U.S.
And they've tightened censorship about that.
Oh, massively.
Wildly.
Massively. Yes. Iran claims it's hit 10 radar systems in total, and Iran's not, they may get some things wrong, but they're not BSing, really, and there's a lot of evidence that this is true. They hit
We said about Trump and that Iranian minister, a lot of people in the government, quite high, the U.S. government, don't get somebody who's not bluffing, and Iran is not.
Yeah. Iran took out an ANFPS-132 radar. This is a billion-dollar radar system in Qatar that protects the Al Udeid base, the American base there, which is the largest American military base in the whole region. Again, they're doing this to blind the U.S. and make the Gulf states, who are already very vulnerable, but for these systems, vulnerable, very vulnerable. And I think this is important to point out. The Iranians have not played their cards yet. The Iranians have started to play some cards, but I think this is what the foreign minister and others have tried to get across to that meathead, that the Iranians have barely, they're not stupid, they're playing cards to show, to credibly demonstrate they can cause pain, but they have so many cards yet to play that can cause so much more pain.
One of the first things an Iranian spokes, as they say in the news biz, said was, we will just wait to see what they try, because basically in the U.S. Colloquial sense, we've been gaming this for decades.
Yes, exactly.
And we know what's going to happen.
They really did, too. And it's, I have to say, it's kind of amazing, because for some reason in my mind, I just assume everybody involved in defense, maybe because I'm American, is totally corrupt. And so they have like pinheads coming up with scenarios, but the real people just do business, and it has nothing to do with preparing for an actual war. And I guess when you are actually a weaker country, and you know you will get attacked at some, that it's very likely that the corruption is going to work much differently, and you have to actually prepare. Like, having enemies like the U.S. and Israel sharpens your focus a lot.
Yeah.
And, so what else did they take out? There was a THAAD radar system in Jordan, TPY-2. And by the way, these systems, like especially the one in Qatar, they're not easy to rebuild. None of these systems are. They are not just expensive. I mean, the U.S. can always print and borrow money. But, for example, the one that was taken out in Qatar, I know for sure, and probably the other ones, relies a lot on critical minerals that only China produces. And China has slapped, because of Trump's tariffs, they imposed basically a ban on exporting any of these critical minerals without special licenses. You think China is eager to have the U.S. rebuild its, you know, radar systems while the U.S. is stationing green berets on Taiwanese-controlled islands right off the Chinese mainland? I mean, it's just...
This is when one of my favorite cautious sayings comes into play. Courtesy costs nothing. I mean, we got a lot of blowhards in power at the moment. And especially, I guess, in courteous cultures, and there are some and some are not, that people have long memories. Mm-hmm. And you should have been nice, or you should have at least been polite.
Yeah. Yeah, again, it's this sense of total impunity. And that has definitely been fostered by the fact that in this country, the rich and the powerful have not been held, I mean, to say they've not been held accountable for decades is putting it very mildly. They've been advanced and enriched for failing the rest of the country and for causing, you know, catastrophic failures in Iraq, failures in the crashing the whole economy, et cetera, et cetera. In every aspect of the American society, media, academia, it's just, it's the failures, the corrupt failures who are in with the right people who rise up and up. There's no downside that they've been trained to grasp for failing. Like, it's so, yeah, so that's what we're stuck with.
A few things get to them, and one of them is elite sexual abuse of kids, and that was one of the things that got them enraged, and now I really see many, many replies to various articles by Trump fans who say, I'm sick of this story, you know, the Epstein Island story. And there are some people, undoubtedly, I would guess, well, never mind what they're like, but who are sufficiently by-the-book reactionary to turn on a dime. Yeah. Like they did about the war. Trump's not going to start any war.
I didn't think he would do this war. I mean, until it started to become clear he would. I didn't think, because it's so obvious. It's so obvious that this war was going to go badly. And that I really didn't. I didn't think he would do a full-on war. I thought he might still keep playing around with kind of spectacles like coming in at the very end of the 12-day war or assassinating Soleimani, those kind of things, kidnapping Maduro. Like maybe another slight bombing somewhere or some kidnapping, I don't know, somewhere. But not a full George W. Bush-like war against Iran, just the dumbest fucking thing imaginable. Anyway, getting back to some of these other radars that were hit, Iran hit three radar domes in Kuwait at Camp Arif John, the American base there. They damaged satellite radar and at the Bahrain Fifth Fleet base. There was smoke detected from radar from a Saudi base, the Prince Sultan Air Base, where we were, where we had a lot of assets there, tankers and maybe AWACS. In the meantime, the Gulf states and Iran have had this kind of weird, undeclared war sort of thing going on. It's kind of interesting because the Iranians, the Gulf states are pretending like they are not directly participating or that their hands are tied or that they're not involved in this. So the Iranians are calibrating their strikes on the Gulf states depending on what they perceive as the level of involvement, it seems like. So they seem to be hitting the Saudis less because that Saudi-Iran rapprochement was very important, I think, to the Iranians and to the Saudis. Whereas the UAE, they've launched by far the most missiles and drones at the UAE, which is the state that is openly closest to Israel and the U.S. and is, you know, as we've talked about, the most kind of aggressively militaristic by far of the Gulf states. And they've been paying a pretty heavy price for it, but it's still not open warfare. You know, in Bahrain.
Iran did say today, though, that it would yes. allow anybody free, unhindered passage through the Gulf and that choke point that it's sort of holding in reserve at the moment.
If they expel the U.S. and Israeli ambassadors and basically shut down their embassies, which is just, it's a beast move, I think. And they confine that only to Middle Eastern and European countries. They're not making that same demand of, for example, the Chinese or the Russians or the Asians. You know, and that's another story, the extent to which the Russians are helping. We can talk about that. As for the U.S., Hegseth came out and he had an interview yesterday where he basically said this guy is just so ridiculous. First, he just spends, 10 minutes glazing Trump and Trump's power and Trump's genius. And then he basically said, you haven't seen anything yet. Now the gloves are coming off. See, now he said this on day one. Now you're going to see for the first time what an anti-woke gloves off campaign is going to be like, and we're going to completely destroy them. 10 days later, Iran's not destroyed, and Iran has actually caused enormous pain, and the Trump administration is getting calls from all the rich people all over the world telling them to end the fucking war now. So their response to that is to say, we might end it now, but also we are so strong, we could just completely obliterate and destroy Iran. And so now Hegseth is saying, now we're going to fight an anti-woke gloves-off war against Iran.
Which means, in his way of thinking, that he had a quote, something like, if you're not Iranian, you won't get killed. If you're Iranian, you should worry.
Yes, I know.
Hegseth, you're supposed to make some distinction, phony as you like, but there's got to be something there between 12-year-old civilians and 50-year-old officers.
So supposedly they're carrying out their largest bombing campaign of the war today to show that they can keep bombing. They're hitting residential areas. They're hitting cities around the country. Again, it's a country of almost 100 million people, 92 million people. I'm sure they're hitting military sites. They have hit more Iranian naval vessels, which again, though, this is not the Iranian Navy is not what's keeping the Strait of Hormuz closed. What's keeping it closed is a single drone hitting anybody going through there eliminates any chance for insurance, and nobody's going to want to sail through that anyway. And even Trump coming in, Trump said the U.S. will kind of backstop any container ships, oil containers or fertilizer container ships, insurance. But it actually turns out, I heard some more about that, that it really only covers a tiny part of it. And it was either Trump or was it Lindsey Graham or one of them, Hegseth, one of them was saying, or the energy secretary maybe was saying, come on, container ships, don't be pussies. What are you? Are you afraid to go through? It's like, Jesus Christ. Do it for freedom.
I get this crummy salary paid in, I don't know, Malaysian dollars. And you want me to take a slow ship through a tortuous, sudden turn and very narrow passage. And meanwhile, Iran is the Iranian elite, that is saying, it has elected Khamenei's son.
Yeah, Mojtaba.
Right, as his successor. Appointing his son is a very determined way of saying, we're staying, as an American politician would say, the course.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. This was actually, and maybe we should have even mentioned this earlier, because I think this is one of the most significant events of this war so far, because Trump and Netanyahu, Trump especially, Trump's made a lot of hay about the fact that he wants to choose and demands to choose, and he thinks he's forcing them, forcing the Iranians to choose somebody to Trump's liking, that they're so beaten down, they're so terrified, they're losing so badly, that they're looking for a way out of it. And the most, the kind of one of the clearest ways that you would see that would be if the Iranians chose what Trump would consider to be a cynical pragmatist. That's the kind of person he wants to see there, who will do a deal. Trump's already said that he doesn't, he's not even pretending to give a shit about restoring democracy or any of that. He wants somebody who will be like a Delcy Rodriguez for him. And
he even said that. He said, yes. You know, Delcy's yeah. a great pal.
And I think we should keep our eye on that. I mean, Delcy's in a much, much, much weaker position than the Iranians, and is going to try and outlast this nightmare. But I don't think that Delcy Rodriguez, I could be wrong, is planning to, I think they're doing this because they have a gun pointed at their head, and that the minute that gun is lifted, you know, they're going to try and go back to Chavista politics as much as they possibly can. But anyway, getting back to this, so Iran naming Mojtaba, if I'm saying that right, Khamenei, the son of the assassinated Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, as the new leader, as the supreme leader. He's been known as somebody who's also very close to the IRGC, to the Revolutionary Guards. He is known as a, quote, hardliner. His father, wife, and his own son were all killed together in the assassination of Khamenei. He has developed long old ties to the Revolutionary Guards and the military. So choosing him is absolute defiance from the Iranian state. You know, this is the Iranian regime. I don't know why regime is considered a bad word. It's French, so it must be bad, I guess. But when we say regime, we just mean the whole structure of the state, which is vast and deep. And this is clearly a very big fuck you to Trump, to show that they have not at all been, been broken by this. And in fact, they are much more defiant, and they have consolidated around themselves. Like, they are hunkering down for this war, and they are in it, and they keep saying it, and they're not bullshitting. They are not looking for a way out of this war, the Iranians. They are looking for a settlement.
I think that was a big shock to Trump's administration and a lot of the American media. Like, okay, this is the stage where they start to panic and beg us to stop. Nobody begged. Nobody begged for nothing.
Yeah. I think one of the strategies for the U.S. Israel, or Usrael, as sometimes I've spelled that way, U-S-R-A-E-L, Usrael, is to, like, the Iranians, of course, are widening the war, but I think the Americans, are trying really hard, and the Israelis, to widen the war in the sense that they get the Gulf states directly involved. They're going to want to try and restoke the Sunni Shia sectarianism, Sunni against Shia. So far, it's not working. The U.S. is trying so hard to suck them in. Lindsey Graham, and he's Lindsey Graham, if you've watched him, he's completely, even by Lindsey Graham's crazy simpering ways, has gone completely off his rocker lately. Like, I don't know if you've noticed this. He said, I'm going back to South Carolina to tell parents there to send their children to war in the Middle East.
You have to be really, really crazy. A lot of patriotic MAGA families seem to be very much against sending their kids over there, but not Lindsey.
No, I mean, everyone's for sending somebody else's kids, but not their own. It's nuts. Yeah, he's been like signing off, God bless Israel, and this is my loyalties are with Israel. He keeps saying that over and over. But the other thing that he's done,
God, what did they have him on video?
Exactly.
Doing?
I know that with him, I believe it more than that's what's motivating Trump. I think Trump is.
Yeah.
That might be partly what's motivating Trump, but I think this is absolute Trump. But Graham is so weird. And one thing I thought was really strange was Graham, like when the Israelis, I think it was, were the ones that bombed the oil refineries that set like streets in Tehran on fire, if you saw that, and yeah. set, you know, the acid rain and the apocalyptic
smoke. A lot of Murdoch-type papers were gloating about it. They were talking about how nice the flames are. But the trouble is, petrochemical fires are spectacular, whether they're a gas pump or a giant refinery. It's not hard to do that with petrochemicals. Yeah.
And Graham took to X and released this big statement, which was like 90% fawning to Israel and how great Israel is. And then a kind of, but me. Just dial back the bombing of the oil terminals a bit, because we plan to actually take those and make money off of it. So
he even said we'll make so much money.
Yeah.
What do you mean we? I mean, it was,
yeah.
I have a lot of secret oil stock.
I know. But I just thought it was interesting that he felt he had to go. I mean, this is a guy, are the Israelis not taking his calls? Like, why did he need to go on X? To try to reach them. And he's been doing a lot of diplomacy on X. On X, he went on this rant at the Saudis. Come on, Saudi Arabia, get directly involved. This is for you. You could be king. Come on, UAE. He's been doing these like weird open statements as if nobody's talking to him anymore. So all he can do is go on X or on Fox News because the important people won't take his calls anymore. It's pretty strange. So getting back to trying to get the Gulf states involved, and other states involved, there have been some interesting stuff just to keep our eye on. For example, as I've said, the Gulf states are trying to play this game that they're not directly involved. So the Iranians are making sure to mostly target, except in some cases, but to keep most of their targeting on U.S. bases and U.S. assets. I think the Iranians also took out a CIA station building in Riyadh. I mean, again, this also points to how really good the Iranian intelligence is. And
yeah, long ago, they have clearly marked out a lot of buildings that are to be hit when the war starts. And they seem to have done a really good job of that. Every intelligence HQ, in fact, a big Israeli intelligence HQ got hit early on.
Right.
And I'm sure that they've hit many American bases as well.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot. Again, we have to emphasize this again. There is an enormous amount of censorship. In Bahrain, they've announced that it's a death penalty for posting videos. Other states, there's, you know, they've announced jail terms and probably worse for people posting videos. So there's a lot we're not seeing, but that can't hide the fact that that oil is shooting up, gasoline shooting up, there are shortages, and there is panic. And that's, I mean, you could see it from Lindsey Graham. Now, Trump's not going to show panic. He may not even be panicking because he's really lost touch with reality, even within his own world, which is already, there are articles that have come out about how there is a sense of panic at the sort of non-public levels in Washington right now. But anyway, so there are some strange things, as I said. One of them was, I think it was Department of Defense yesterday, boasted about how its HIMARS missiles, which also hit, I think it was either electricity or oil infrastructure. It posted a photo of the HIMARS missiles being fired from a U.S. base in the Middle East. And everybody knew right away, oh, that's Kuwait. So that's a way to put a bead on Kuwait and saying, you know, this. And then just in case it wasn't obvious enough, this morning Hegseth came out and said, and I'll quote, Gulf states have been willing to go on the offensive and have been giving us access, basing, and overflight in a new partnership that will continue to remake the region. So we are trying to get the Iranians to hit Gulf states more, to force the Gulf states to become more directly involved. And then there have been some other strange things, like some drones that hit Azerbaijan a few days ago. Azerbaijan is very close to the Israelis, CIA, but also Turkey. And Turkey does not like this war. And when those drones hit in Nakhchivan, the exclave that's kind of sandwiched between Armenia, Turkey, and Iran, Aliyev, the dictator of Azerbaijan, came out with a very strong statement, practically threatening war. And then shortly after that, it was either Erdogan or his foreign minister came out and said, addressed it to Aliyev and said, do not let the Zionists suck you into this war. This is a disaster and don't go in. And not long after that, Azerbaijan started delivering humanitarian aid to Iran. And Aliyev made a very public display of giving humanitarian aid. There was also a drone that hit a British base in Cyprus. We did a whole series on how the British got control of pieces of Cyprus, thanks to the U.S. and its love of Turkey and so on.
All the bright foreign policy decisions made in the early phase of the Cold War, just one of which made Iranian a permanent enemy of the United States.
Yep. So the Iranians are saying that these have been false flag attacks. We don't know. I mean, they could either be A, deliberate attacks by Iran sending a message, B, mistaken attacks by Iran, because electronic jamming can send a drone in the wrong direction or you can lose control of it, or C, false flag attacks. I mean, the Americans and the Israelis would love for Azerbaijan to open a northern front and sucker them in on, in order to expand Azerbaijan. I mean, the dictator of Azerbaijan, Ilhan Aliyev, he is a absolute maniac. He ethnically cleansed the entire Armenian population of Artsakh out of Artsakh, and he has been styling himself as some kind of greater Azerbaijan, leader. And of course, Iran has a massive Azeri minority. In fact, the Khamenei's, I think, come from that, at least partly from the, they're part Azeri, I believe, and from that region. They have West Azerbaijan or Azeristan or whatever. I mean, they have regions in Iran named West and, I believe, North or South.
Yeah, a lot of the Caspian shoreline or
the
provinces next to it are heavily Azeri.
Yeah. So I think that's one thing to watch out for is, and I think it's a terrible idea, and it's so clear that the Gulf states do not want to be dragged in. They're very much, they're angry about this because business is being destroyed. In fact, the head of Aramco, which is the Saudi state oil and gas company, the largest oil company in the world, it was MBS is one of his big moves a few years after he basically came to power, was to list for the first time ever some of the shares of Aramco on global stock exchanges and get in foreign investors. And just today, the head of Aramco said that it is facing a catastrophe from this war.
Right, right. I mean, a lot of their rage was Miller's Crossing rage, as it were. Like, he pays for protection, he gets protection.
Yes.
What's so wrong with that? That's it. Johnny, whatever his name is.
Johnny Casper, yeah.
Yeah, and that's roughly what they thought they were paying for. Where's the protection? And they were very angry, publicly angry in some cases. American bases are being protected, and Israel in general is being protected, or so they thought. But we get the cut-rate security guard. It later turned out like nobody's getting protected.
Yes.
We're all in the same sinking ship.
I'm sorry. I think Johnny Casper's quips about the schmatter. They write themselves in this scenario, but
they
won't go there.
I got nothing to do with it.
It's Coen Brothers. It's their joke. They're Jews. Yeah. They're also Jews. But anyways,
I never heard that expression, that noun before.
I know.
Did you?
No, I hadn't, and I've only know it from Miller's Crossing.
Right.
And it must have been a thing in the 30s or the 20s, I guess. You know,
it's yeah, they clearly had a dictionary of Depression-era slang.
Yes, yes. The last quote I just wanted to say here is from a very powerful Iranian political and Revolutionary Guards figure. I think he's the head of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Larijani. He's considered, you know, one of the hardliners, and he just kind of wrote back at Trump, again, with all the bluster that's coming from Trump and Hegseth, and he said, quote, "Iran doesn't fear your empty threats." Even, I think this was in response to Trump saying he was going to rain down hell, unlike anything Iran has ever seen, and basically Iran may not even exist soon. And he says, quote, "Iran doesn't fear your empty threats. Even those bigger than you couldn't eliminate Iran. Be careful not to get eliminated yourself."
There's a certain stylishness, like a Spartan threat, yes, about that. The famous Spartan threat being, "Your cicadas will chirp from the ground." It's one of those that took even the Greeks a couple of seconds to figure out. My cicada. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Last two things here, and we'll try and transition to some other news. But another thing to keep an eye out for is Harg Island. This is a key island that pours out of the waterway into the Persian Gulf. It's key for Iran because it has a lot of important oil facilities and some military facilities there. The Iraqis tried taking it throughout the 1980 through 88 war and failed to. And for Iran, it is a lifeline. If the U.S. were to try to occupy it and take it, the idea is, and this has been floating around among all the big brains in the Trump and think tank world, the sort of mask gloves off anti-woke types, if you take Harg, you basically have Iran by the balls. That's what they think. It's the one chess piece that if you grab it, Iran can't do anything ever if you have it. The thing is, if it's even takeable, and I really doubt it is, short of you know, a draft and amassing all of America's might and doing a full-scale invasion.
Right, and the question of that is, like, remember Iraq? A much weaker country, really. And how did that occupation go? Because you can't just bomb an island and then consider it pacified. You're going to have to put people on the streets and they're going to die.
And if they do this, I think this would be considered basically like a nuclear attack. Mm-hmm. I mean, this would unleash whatever Iran's holding back, I think. And everybody knows it. And so the question is, we know Trump and his people are crazy and it's sort of like kids who are going to do a school shooting together and they talk each other into it. And I mean, we're going to find out how really stupid, like what level of stupid crazy the Trump people are.
Yeah,
if
it's
really
a combination of stupid, crazy, mean. It's like Ignatius J. Riley's mother says to him, like, you're not just crazy, Ignatius, you mean.
Yeah. So another front that's been opened up, of course, is over Syria. Israel actually launched a pretty large, you might call a full-scale invasion or incursion into Lebanon last night. Israel has already displaced about 15% of the population from its bombing campaigns, and it's barely even registers in the news, like something 800,000 or more internally displaced refugees within Lebanon, and they crossed the border. And as far as I can tell, you know, it's hard. Again, everything is so censored, but we are getting these reports, and we even have some video to go with it. Hezbollah staged an ambush on a town that's right across the border, kind of near Kiryat Shmona, which is the Israeli city on the border, in a town called Chaim, I think is how it's pronounced, Chaim, That was the name of my great, great, great grandfather, Sephardic one from, you know, grew up in Palestine. An ambush there. They took out the Hezbollah, I think had an IED that blew up one Merkava. Another Merkava came. They went after it with anti-tank missiles. Then the Israelis came in to try to rescue the two tanks and got ambushed, and more were wounded, maybe killed. And
that's how the 1982 campaign. You go over the border too precipitously, and you run into things that have been prepared on that side for months or years, but you haven't prepared at all.
Yeah, and like 2006 for that matter. You know, the Israelis have prepared, but I think, again, they might have, whereas they did properly estimate Hezbollah's power after 2006 and did, you know, I'm not supporting it at all, but I'm just saying this from a, you know, observer's point of view. They did really weaken Hezbollah.
They really
badly.
They hurt Hezbollah with the pagers. Very badly.
And killing Nasrallah and
and
taking out a lot of their rocket capabilities. But Hezbollah has not been taken out. This was something Cyrus, you know, this is something Cyrus said. This is something that I remember Anibale saying a while back, you know, reminding us that the mammals started, the first proto-mammals appeared, I think it was in the late Permian, it might have been, or just after the Permian, whichever the one comes right after that. And then the dinosaurs kind of supplanted them. But then, of course, mammals came back with a vengeance, you know, after the KT event. That, I mean, the point being that because the conditions are always going to be there for a Hezbollah because of what Israel is doing and because there are Shia there, that they will come back. I just didn't expect that they would. I'm only speaking now of the early days because we don't know where this is going. But I really didn't expect in these early days that Hezbollah would have this much capacity. They've been blooding the Israelis. They severely wounded that fascist Smotrich finance minister's son. He got shrapnel in his liver from an attack. They've been hitting with missiles Haifa, Kiryat Shmona, a lot of areas in northern Israel. And they're clearly coordinating some of these missile attacks with Iran. And how they're doing that, God knows. Mm. And another development in that, I don't know if you saw this, John, is that as the Israeli incursion began, one of the ways the Israelis came in was kind of flying in their special forces from their territory in occupied Syria over Syria proper and then into I think sort of a Hezbollah region just inside Lebanon. And when they did that, Hezbollah fired back rockets. And immediately after that, Jolani, our Al-Qaeda puppet, came out and basically said, this is an invasion. It's the first time he's been upset about getting invaded because Israel occupies, you know, a chunk of his country. So he massed some troops on the border to help relieve the Israelis. So basically we have, in a very open way, Al-Qaeda's former leader working together with Israel and Trump.
Yeah, he's been altogether less circumspect than I would have thought. Like, you'd think somebody who's supposedly a militant Islamist would be at least pretending to be pro-Islam, anti-Zionist, but not at all, really. Not in any way that's convincing.
Yeah, he knows who helped him
and
put him into power. And his hold on the country is, well, it is strengthening and centralizing. Mm. And I think he just sees Trump and Israel as his allies in taking control of the country. And if the price is having Israel occupying a part of it for some indefinite period of time, then he's happy with that. Yeah, he's
it's just strange. Like, I don't know what the half-life of a Trump thing is.
Yeah,
I mean, how long does a Trump organism survive in a real biosphere?
Yeah. Well, I think what he does to keep his Islamist fighters and minions happy is just sick them on minorities within Syria.
Right. A lot of minorities.
And they're happy doing that because those people are defenseless and Israel can fight back. And they won't go after Hezbollah unless Hezbollah looks defenseless, which it might be. But anyway, Hezbollah does look like they have a lot more capacity than a lot of us expected at this point so far. I think because this war, and this is the biggest war. We've covered a lot of wars. It's not the deadliest war, not so far, but it is the most consequential war, I think, since we've started our podcast. And I don't mean to in any way minimize the far gorier wars that we've tried to bring attention to in the Horn of Africa in particular.
Congo. I mean, the Congo. It's a lot easier to get details on this war. That's a big part of it.
But it also, its effect on the global economy, and it's just, I can't emphasize this enough, it is just beginning. And it's not going to be, the negative effects are not going to be turned off with a switch. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. We just know it is negatively affecting in a big way. You know, that's the economy is kind of like, when it has a shock like this, it's kind of like war. It's very unpredictable. I mean, there's always that tiny chance that Trump could get lucky like he did with tariffs and it doesn't turn out to be as devastating. But it looks like Trump's string of luck is running out here in a pretty big way. So I did want to mention the Ukraine war only because it's the fourth anniversary. And there is so little coming out on the Ukraine war. And that alone, I think, is so interesting because this was all anybody wanted to talk about, certainly in the rich world.
Fickle those richies are.
Yeah. And I think, in a sense, maybe one of the most important developments, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of movement in the war to report on. And that could be just as much that there hasn't been a lot of movement in this war in since the first few months, or the first, let's say, 6 months anyway. And now these little, you know, did Russia take 80% of a town of 10,000 people, or did they take 60%? Like these stories are just not as interesting anymore. We just see it for what it is, which is a war of attrition that is very bogged down. So I think, in a sense, and all the OSINT bros, they've all abandoned that war for this one. So I think, in a sense, the more important thing is that peace talks look like they're dead. You know, the spike in oil prices and the supply cut has been a massive boon for Russia. The Europeans were crowing until just a few weeks ago that they thought they finally had the Russian economy where they wanted it, because Trump actually turned up sanctions on Russian oil and gas in a way that even Biden didn't. He was forcing Lukoil and Rosneft, these two major Russian oil companies, to sell off some of their major assets under sanctions threat. He forced Russia out of the Indian market. That's all done now, it looks like. So Russia's making huge amounts of money from the rise in the price of oil, and Trump is now rescinding giving waivers for all these sanctions against Russian oil and gas, because he's trying to put more oil and gas into the markets to keep the price down as much as he can. And the Europeans aren't even pretending to care about that. They want the price down too. So that seems to me a really big deal. And it kind of had me thinking, because Trump put an enormous amount of effort, it was kind of wild actually looking back, into trying to force, whether by strong-arming the Ukrainians or strong-arming the Russians, trying to force a ceasefire. He spent a year on that and a lot of time. And I know that people I've talked to sort of from the diplomatic community sort of thought, well, I mean, the reason Biden didn't do this is because it just looked like it had such a small chance of succeeding, because the two sides are so far apart. Russia has maximal demands, and Ukraine does not want to capitulate. And so it's the kind of war that will be decided on the battlefield. And Trump wouldn't take no for an answer. It's kind of surprising for a guy who's kind of known for having a short attention span. And now that this Iran war has happened, and it's on. And now we know that Russia is providing some crucial intelligence help and know-how and possibly hardware help to the Iranians, I think it's important to look back and consider the possibility that the reason Trump has been working so hard for a ceasefire is to get Russia out of the game in which the U.S. and Russia are on, on opposite sides.
That's a very good point. Yeah,
and kind of like make nice with the Russians again and not give them an incentive to help the Iranians. In other words, Trump has had his eye on this Iran war, I think, for a long time. That is one thing I draw from this, at least the possibility of doing this Iran war for his place in history, his legacy, and he thinks he can do these things that others were too woke and too scared to do.
Well, if he wanted to do that before he went out, maybe conquer Greenland or something.
I know. Do something less stupid. I mean, I thought of that because I think one of the reasons Biden pulled out of Afghanistan so precipitously, I mean, again, one of the few good things Biden did was finally end that war, but it was done pretty hastily. He did it a few months after he came to power and, as we've talked about, very deliberately provoked Russia and very deliberately encouraged Ukraine to take a hard line against Russia. And months before he pulled out of Afghanistan, he already saw that Putin was starting to mass forces and threaten an invasion. So we got out of Afghanistan so that the Russians couldn't hit back, so that we weren't vulnerable to some kind of, Russian payback. And that actually worked. Trump kind of did the opposite. I don't know. He's like, in order to try to force Russia to agree to a ceasefire or end the hostilities, he's actually, as I said, not only ramped up sanctions, but really has expanded at times what he's allowed the U.S. to provide Ukraine in terms of intelligence and how deep and how hard, he's allowed Ukraine with the Americans to hit inside Russia. And he didn't get his ceasefire. The U.S. has been very hostile to Russia in the Ukraine war under Trump. And obviously, the Russians are going to help the Iranians. And here we are, and he just couldn't wait. So, here we are.
I think that sums it up. Here we are.
Yeah, here we are. So
it's like being stranded, on the 101 somewhere near the Oakland Coliseum. It's like, oh, God, this place.
Yeah, forever. So I think we can end this episode here. And as I said, we're working, I think our next episode should also be a really good one. We're going to have a friend of the show, Cyrus, back on to tell us more about what's happening inside Lebanon, and because that's where Israel is really opening up. And there's even talk that Israel... I mean, there's talk, John, that both either Israel is trying to like say, okay, this war is yours now to the Americans and leave the Americans with Iran. But then there's opposite talk coming out of the Trump administration that they're like, okay, Israel, we did you a favor. Now the Iran war is yours. And but anyway, we'll have Cyrus on and an update and so on in a couple of days. So thank you, everyone, again.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks John and Brendan. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.